Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Duke Health, offering food, medication delivery, and transportation to communities hardest hit by COVID-19. It's all through a special partnership with North Carolina agencies and 16 community-based organizations. Learn more about Duke's COVID-19 response at dukehealth.org.
This is Tested from WUNC, a look at how we're responding to the day's challenges in North Carolina and the South. I'm Jason DeBruin.
To me, it doesn't make sense, but it is what it is, and I don't know what can be done about it.
Wes Martin spent days in the Wilkes Medical Center emergency room in early September, his wife Jerry at his side.
I mean, everyone there is sick, sick, sick. And they call it boarding in the ER, which means you're just hanging out there until they can get somewhere.
To pass time and take their minds off Wes's sudden respiratory condition, she started a daily Facebook post titled Tales from the ER. He's a theater arts teacher at West Wilkes High School, and Jerry says his students message him daily.
So he's beloved. He's beloved by his students, and I know they miss him, and they love doing shows, and they can't do them without him. So it affects a lot of people in the community when, you know, just one person gets sick.
After 60 hours in the ER, Wes was transferred to Atrium Wake Forest Baptist Hospital, where he was told he had a paralyzed right diaphragm and probably chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, known as COPD. After two nights there, he was sent home and told to see a pulmonologist. But 4 days later, his oxygen levels fell perilously low, and he went back to the local ER. This time, he waited 85 hours. After which, he was sent home with antibiotics in an oxygen tank.
Now we wait until we can get an outpatient appointment and get an outpatient bronchoscopy so he can get better.
He still has trouble breathing, but knows it's not COVID-19. Not only is he vaccinated, but he's been masking up for months, and he's had multiple negative COVID tests since entering the hospital the first time.
So that's where we are. It's just a shame. We just shouldn't be here.
More than getting sick himself, Wes is upset and frustrated with unvaccinated COVID patients. He feels like he would have been seen more quickly and had more attention from hospital staff if it weren't so full with COVID patients.
It's a nightmare there.
It really is. I don't know how else to say it other than they're using up all the services. They're using up all the people, they're using up all the beds, and I really and truly feel like it's because of the unvaccinated. You know, they won't get the shot, they won't wear their masks, but when they get sick, they'll certainly go to the hospital.
Across the state, hospital staff continue to work overtime to expand capacity. WakeMed has converted parts of its lobbies into surge space. UNC Rex has delayed opening the Holly Springs Hospital to concentrate staff at other facilities. A spokesman for Wilkes Medical Center said he understands the frustrations of patients like the Martins and urged unvaccinated people to get the shot. He added that hospitals have expanded virtual care settings and asked that people seeking COVID tests not go to the emergency rooms. There are still more than 3,000 people currently hospitalized with COVID-19 in North Carolina. Meanwhile, fewer than two-thirds of adults are fully vaccinated. But for many vaccinated people, images of crowded emergency rooms have turned into anger. Some would like to see people who have been vaccinated and wearing masks get priority medical treatment at hospitals. They say just as hospitals routinely triage patients, why not include vaccination status as one of those factors in that triage?
The idea of cutting the line as a question, I think, is a difficult question.
Stephen Benko is an ethics professor at Meredith College.
So if you say that somebody's cutting the line, we're automatically assuming that there is a morally appropriate or morally acceptable order with which patients should receive care. And we as a society haven't really codified that. Like, we kind of do first come, first served. we don't have, because we've never had to deal with this, we don't really have clear guidance on who moves ahead and who has to maybe step back for somebody else. I think what's interesting is that we seem to be creating another class of people, and we can call them like the vaccine hesitant or the vaccine obstinate, but we seem to be creating another class of people, and I think this is thoroughly American, that's like, you're making your own bed, you're going to have to sleep in it. But we're gonna create this class of people and essentially blame them for being what they are. We've done that before. We certainly did that with HIV. The medical violence that has been visited upon like other communities in American history certainly contains some of this weird rhetoric of they don't deserve, for some behavioral reason, the same care that other people deserve. And I'm troubled by that idea.
I think taking a step back and looking at it, you know, there are lots of things and there are lots of situations in which we don't exactly follow our physician's advice, right? We don't do everything that we're supposed to do.
That's Dr. Benny Joyner. He's the Division Chief of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine at North Carolina Children's Hospital.
I am also a lead consultant for the Clinical Ethics Service for UNC Health. And I can give a number of anecdotes, you know, about those situations in which, you know, I don't eat as well as I should be probably, you know, and I don't exercise as much as I should, you know, if I have an incident, should someone else who has exercised and eaten correctly and done all those things somehow get priority over me if I present to the ED, simply because I may not have listened to, you know, someone's advice. And I think we would probably say, well, no, you know, obviously if it's an accident or, you know, but I think in this time, everybody's, you know, emotions are amped up. We are in a state of emergency. It's these times in which we're challenged that we need to adhere by the principles that we live by. And what I was charged to do was to care for anybody coming in the door. And, you know, I don't ask about vaccination status, you know, as a marker for how I'm going to treat you.
Well, and you kind of hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, about that now, you know, these are tough times right now. I think the saying, I won't get this exactly right, but it's something along the lines of your ethics or your character aren't tested when times are easy. They're tested when times are difficult. And that's exactly when it's important to have these foundational beliefs so that, yeah, when it's easy, it's fine, no problem. It's when they're hard, that's, of course, when these are really tested. And that's sort of what you all are going through right now.
Right. And I think that that's absolutely right. Even as we make, you know, decisions and have discussions about, you know, what therapies we're going to provide to patients, whether they have COVID or they don't have COVID, you know, in the face of all of these conversations about, you know, concern for rationing, concern for scarce resources, it would not be unreasonable and it would be ethical, I believe. And we've had conversations about this, that looking at a patient, two patients being completely equal to 50-year-old men, you know, who have the same comorbidities, you know, exactly the same weight, exactly the same height, you know, come in and, but for their difference, are vaccinated, unvaccinated, I do think it would be reasonable to look at, you know, how to treat those patients differently in a scarce resource allocation. Because again, vaccination, what's been overwhelmingly demonstrated is that vaccinated patients tend to do better, you know, tend to not end up in the ICU. And so in an area or a situation in which you have two patients who are exactly alike, looking at vaccination status after looking at all other aspects is a very reasonable approach.
Right. And certainly, you know, some behaviors do impact other decisions as well. I know I'm thinking of, for instance, if you're an alcoholic, it's more difficult to get a liver transplant, or in many cases, you have to stop drinking for several months before you can qualify for a liver transplant. So it wouldn't be completely unheard of, but clearly there are several, many other factors that should be considered ahead of vaccination status, is I think what it sounds like.
Right. And I think that that's absolutely right. And that was another example that we could look at and we've used. But I also want to point out that there are also some very relevant and some very important socioeconomic and potentially racial implications, you know, of deciding by vaccine status. I mean, we've heard story over and over again, despite the fact that there's wide availability of the vaccine, but for an individual's inability to get off of work, to be able to go and make time to go to the local, you know, Department of Health or to their local community hospital to get vaccinated, they haven't been able to do it. For whatever reason, they've not been able to get time off. Their obligations don't allow them to make the time to be able to get the vaccine. So I do worry that if we were to somehow use vaccine status, you know, as a way to triage patients, that there would be some unintended consequences and unintended biases that were baked in. You know, for a lot of communities, there isn't that consistent representative, right? There isn't that consistent healthcare provider. And so most of the care is either provided, you know, at in the emergency room or at some urgent care in which there's not a relationship that's being developed. And so I think that, you know, for something as serious as this, for something as serious as a vaccine, I think there is a lot of distrust. And I think that that's unfortunate given the amount of misinformation that's out there. It's easy to see why it's occurring, but, you know, I think that's why I feel very strongly that we shouldn't punish those individuals who have been deceived, you know, in the past. And again, here we are saying, well, no, because you don't trust me now. Now we're going to say you are going to go to the back of the line. And so, you know, overall, I wouldn't do that with somebody who didn't take the statin I prescribed them or that didn't take, you know, my advice about eating healthy. And as such, I don't think that we should do that in this situation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's the vaccine hesitant. It does feel maybe a little bit different, at least again, from a layperson's perspective, when we talk about the vaccine, say, obstinate, those who it feels in some ways actively seek out misinformation. Again, I'm speaking from a layman's perspective. It can feel easy in my mind to perhaps separate those two populations from each other. But I think somebody like yourself probably doesn't want to think of those two as different, or at least if you did, it would become very difficult to determine, you know, okay, well, where is that line? At what point are you here and at what point are you there?
You know, I think that's absolutely right. I think it's hard to distinguish the vaccine hesitant from the vaccine obstinate. Unfortunately, I think our minds are hardwired to try to create these camps. And I think there's some solace in putting individuals in those camps. But one of the things over, you know, nearly two decades of doing this in terms of caring for patients pre-pandemic, if we can remember a time that was pre-pandemic, you know, one of the things that I think is truly important that I have grown to appreciate more and more as I do this is that I have no idea what an individual's gone through. I have zero concept of what their life experience is. And as an ethicist, you know, I think it's important to understand where the narrative that the family or that the individual has. I am never going to convince anybody, you know, who without any information tries to tell me what I see or don't see. You know, I've had conversations like this outside of the hospital in which people say, well, I don't believe that it's real. And, you know, all I can tell them is, well, you know, I'm not wearing the mask. I'm not wearing my eyewear. You know, I'm not leaving my house at 2 a.m, you know, to come to the hospital because I don't want to sleep. You know, I'm not here this morning caring for patients and putting a patient on life support for no reason. You know, this is real and it just takes time, you know, and I think that's one of the hardest things to do, I will say, is that in a sense of, you know, where every second feels so important, you know, to sit down with the family and just say, let's talk about where we're at. And I think that's one of the things that's helped me so much is my ethics hat, which has afforded me an opportunity to frame a lot of these conversations. But I think what the other piece that's helped me really is my ICU hat. You know, there's the sense of urgency is daily in my life.
Maintaining that mindset, I suspect, is sometimes easier said than done. What do those conversations look like when you know, have to perhaps chat with a nurse or a doctor or a colleague who's struggling with a patient, maybe even yourself at times? What do those internal dialogues look like when you're having to try to, okay, let me recenter myself, keep my focus right? What does that look like? What does that feel like?
Yeah, I'm no saint. I've had those very same thoughts. You know, I've had those very same frustrations when I get the call for another admission, you know, for a patient who is unvaccinated, now has COVID pneumonia. We need to admit them to the ICU, and we're struggling for how we can take care of all these patients. You know, I'm not going to lie, those conversations probably aren't ones that I'm very proud of, you know, ones that are in a moment of humanity and humility of just why am I having these conversations? Why can't people understand, you know, the importance of this? But again, I always, just like all those other decisions about treatment options, I view vaccine, you know, hesitancy, vaccine obstinacy the same way. Like the fact that I would have a conversation with the family and say to them, you know, whenever I'm approaching them, I take my deep breath, you know, that internal dialogue of, I remind myself, I don't know where they're at. I don't understand the challenges they face in their life. I don't know what's put them here. And you know, I've been humbled on more than one occasion. I'll tell you, I remember vividly one time when I was just so just frustrated about a particular situation of a patient, a child whose family was not willing to get them vaccinated. And I was so angry, you know, where the child was going to be intubated, you know, all of these, we were going to put dialysis catheters in, you know, this kid was very, very sick and there was an opportunity to get vaccinated. They didn't, you know, but when I sat there and finally took time to sit down and said, hey, what's going on? Like, let's talk about this. You know, this is really important for you and your family. And nothing came out of the first conversation. Nothing even came out of the second conversation. But, you know, by the third conversation, there was very clearly an episode, which, you know, I didn't get on that third conversation, of something bad that happened with the previous vaccine. There was a lot of concern about that happening again. And maybe if I wore masks and social distance that I wouldn't get sick. But as endemic as COVID has become, you know, as reliable as a kid can keep a mask on, although kids are pretty good, to be quite honest, you know, and they're actually a lot better than some adults, I'll say. But I think that, you know, it just came out that there was just a very real fear of something worse than getting COVID happening to their child. And that's a very hard emotion to overcome. And so it took a lot of conversations, a lot of understanding, patience, grace, you know, and that's very hard sometimes. And I'll tell you, after many of those conversations, I'm not proud of myself, but, you know, I went home and was just so frustrated. I just like, why, you know, but the next day you come in and you do it again because the larger goal is more important. And again, none of my thoughts were healthy or pure or even, you know, probably very physician-like, but I think that's the reality, you know, is that I think these are very trying times. And certainly, as much as I've seen, you know, crises, this is something that challenges me every day in new ways.
Well, I'm sure even on your worst day, your thoughts are more pure than mine on my best day. I don't have any question about that. So you hold yourself to a high standard. Dr. Joyner, yeah, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Take care now.
I want to close this episode out with a portion of a conversation I recently had with another ethicist. Jim Thomas studies health ethics at UNC Chapel Hill. He and I talked about the ethical precedents for thinking through this dilemma. And what really stood out to me from our talk was something he mentioned about the broader public health effects for sliding infected, unvaccinated patients to the back of the line.
If somebody is unvaccinated and infected, if they are, let's say, turned away from the hospital in favor of somebody who is, then they're going to be sent back into the community infectious and could lead to more transmission and more infections.
One thought that I've also had, or one, you know, thing that's been proposed is that this sort of slippery slope argument, that if we decide to stop treatment or at least delay treatment, shall we say, to unvaccinated patients, well, where does that stop? Certainly, you know, you could make a perhaps compelling argument that people who overdose on drugs, you know, I'm thinking of the opioid epidemic, clearly there is some self-harm there. That's something that happened that they did to themselves. I guess my thinking is that, you know, at least when we're talking about drug addiction, for instance, you know, drug misuse is classified as an addiction. And I wonder if, you know,
not getting vaccinated because you're listening to some sort of a, you know, misinformation largely, can that be considered like an addiction? I know it's not classified as one, but I wonder if you know, I'm just sort of like trying to think through this a little bit. Maybe I'm pulling at the wrong thread, but I don't know.
Well, that's an interesting thread that you've identified there to consider. You know, many of us are living in information bubbles, and gosh, to classify that as an addiction, I can see where that logic comes from. And I can see how, you know, Facebook, for example, which is the primary mechanisms by which this happens, is designed to be addictive. And so I can see how you might connect some of those dots. I don't know that addiction specialists would argue that not getting vaccinated could be considered as the cause being an addiction. That seems like a bit of a stretch to me.
Or maybe it seems like a stretch for now, and in 20 years with more information, I don't know.
Yeah. It causes one to think, it causes me to think about how much we have really advanced with the internet. And the phenomenon we're seeing now of the rejection of vaccines can be tied to that function of the internet in our society.
That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Jason DeBruin. Thanks for listening.